Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for the next hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your emails and calls. What more could we ask on this beautiful Saturday? And so sit back. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So I wanted to start out today with a rather controversial, to say the least, editorial, which appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The opinion piece, authored by David Ludwig, an obesity specialist at Harvard, talks about the childhood obesity epidemic, and he actually goes so far as to suggest that perhaps extremely obese children whose parents are unable to take action for various reasons of their own might be better off being placed in foster care. Actually, that is a really, really crazy idea, and it comes from desperation, I think. So I'm not trying to castigate this doctor. I believe that he really wants to help obese children, and he sees horrible situations. He described a situation of a 90-pound three-year-old that came to his clinic several years ago. Both of her parents were physically disabled and poor and simply couldn't control her weight. Last year at age 12, she weighed 400 pounds and had already developed diabetes, high cholesterol issues, high blood pressure, and sleep apnea. And that is a true tragedy. Other doctors, in desperation over this issue, have been promoting weight loss surgery for severely obese teens. In other words, gastric bypass, in order to prevent the children or the young teenagers from getting any heavier. We all know that we have an epidemic going on in our society. We have to solve this. It's really very basic. I'm a 50-something-year-old practitioner. I have watched this happen. I've watched our society change in my lifetime. And I've also watched alarming rates of disease. And these are diseases of chronic damage to the body that lead to things like kidney transplants, amputations, blindness. This is no joke. We have a social issue in the United States that has to be addressed. And we also have a mystery, because we don't entirely understand what the drivers are. There are a lot of candidates out there, some of them having to do perhaps with this following story. Pre-pregnancy diet affects future children's health. This story comes from a presentation at the Society for Experimental Biology in Glasgow, Scotland. It was the annual conference, which occurred last week, or 2 weeks ago. And in this study, the researchers had taken mice and fed them a low-protein diet for 10 weeks. Then they had them conceive. In other words, they artificially inseminated them because they're mice. And once they knew the mice were pregnant, they started feeding them a normal diet. Well, the mice gave birth to offspring that had lower birth weights, had catch-up growth after weaning. In other words, they were born at a lower weight, they sped up their weight gain during their infancy, and they had increased insulin sensitivity. Now, this is exactly the same sort of thing you see in offspring of mice who were fed a high-carbohydrate diet, a low-protein, high-carb diet during pregnancy. But this was before pregnancy, so something is getting programmed into the eggs by the diet. Can you say epigenetics? And it is having an effect that persists. Now, in humans, we know this occurs, and we know we have an epidemic of low birth weight, and we know that the poor in this country eat a very high carbohydrate diet. Carbohydrate calories are cheap and subsidized by the government. In an effort to end hunger, which began in the 1970s, the American diet has shifted, and a part of that shift has been an increase in the carbohydrates and a change in the fatty acids. Maybe that's what's driving this, or maybe that's a piece of what's driving this. Here's more research. This is just how bad shape we're in. And this recent study, this was a report that was published by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation just recently. F as in Fat, How Obesity Threatens Americans' Future, 2001. Well, it compares 1995 obesity rates and looks at where they are now. We all would expect they've gone up, but it's really very scary. 20 years ago, the number of U.S. states with an obesity rate above 15% was zero. Now, 12 states have obesity rates over 30%, and every single state, including the state with the lowest obesity rate, which is Colorado, coming in at 19.8%. Well, I take that back. 15%. Wait, everybody has gone up, even the best and healthiest state. What's going on here? I won't bore you with more statistics. I think I made my point. The issues of, can we fix this at the school level? Can we change the fast food? There's been a pledge now. This was big news this week. 19 large restaurant chains, Burger King, Chili's, IHOP, announced that they are going to include healthier options on their children's menus. What's a healthier option? Well, if you sign this pledge, Mr. Restaurateur, you have to offer, this is just makes me laugh, you have to offer at least one meal on your kid's menu that's less than 600 calories. I gavult, to quote one of my colleagues. And there must be a side dish worth less than 200 calories. Well, that's sure going to help with this incredible obesity epidemic. In fact, this just in, the U.S. military is having great difficulty getting enough recruits who are healthy enough to get through boot camp. In fact, in order to staff the military, for the first time in history, they may actually have to lower the standards of training just to have enough warm bodies to put in the chairs. Well, I guess since those warm bodies are mostly driving around in big machines and flying drone planes, maybe that's okay. This is crazy, folks. We as a society need to solve this. We need to look at what's going on elsewhere. We need to find the countries that aren't doing this. We need to take a look at what's different about Colorado, because at least they've kept it down to 4% increase in 20 years as opposed to doubling. So we need to go look at Colorado and figure out what they're doing right and what the rest of us are doing wrong. Another important sort of grouping of stories that came out this week was some research about prostate cancer. Recently published data that goes back at least 10 years, and this is basically looking at prostate cancer progression from 1994 to 2001. The researchers had 1,900 patients, which is a large enough number to really make this research meaningful. And what they looked at was whether or not doing androgen deprivation therapy, ADT, as they're calling it in this study, helped with prostate cancer. Now, there's something called a Gleason score in prostate cancer, and that shows how aggressive the cells appear to be under the microscope. It's basically how many cells are dividing, how messed up their DNA looks. And when you have a Gleason score of 1 or 2 and you have a localized prostate cancer, it doesn't improve your lifespan to undergo androgen deprivation therapy. Under circumstances where you have a Gleason score that is intermediate, say 5 or 6, this study shows that you decrease death rate from prostate cancer. The 10-year death rate in people with an intermediate Gleason score who just had surgery was 8%. If you add in the hormone deprivation therapy, it's 4%. Now, hormone deprivation therapy is using a drug called Lupron, which blocks the sex hormone stimulating release from the pituitary gland. So it is going to really turn off the testicles. It was proposed to be used in the management of sexual offenders, repeat rapists and child molesters, some years ago. And under those circumstances, it was referred to, and I'm quoting, as chemical castration. I think androgen deprivation therapy sounds a lot better and probably sells a lot better to patients. I do find it ironic that how much language creates spin on something like this. Now, just yesterday, one of my patients who has recently undergone therapy for prostate cancer was asking about the vaccination against prostate cancer. This is Provenge, in which your cells are actually taken out of your body and primed to attack your own prostate cancer. I did not know this, but apparently there are television ads for this quote-unquote drug, which was just FDA approved. That's also very crazy. Television ads for highly expensive therapies that have not really been shown to provide a significant benefit to the general public. This drug, if we want to call it a drug, was approved by the FDA on its strength of increasing the lifespan of end-stage prostate cancer patients, people whose prostate cancer has spread throughout their body. It, on the average, increased the lifespan by 4 months. Now, if you're that patient, I agree that that's meaningful. But to now say, okay, it's approved, we can advertise it, and we're going to advertise it to the general public, such that a gentleman like this, who had a low-grade prostate cancer that was effectively treated, and whose risk, really, of death from this prostate cancer over the next 10 years is like 4%, should he have this therapy? Should we be doing this therapy on all prostate cancer patients at $100,000 a pop? How effective is it actually going to be? Well, we don't know, and I don't think they should be promoting it on the air. This latest research that got me thinking about this was published in Nature Medicine on June 19th, so you can see it online if you go look at it. The researchers essentially were doing a mouse study that would be a better, quote-unquote, cheaper way of producing this kind of vaccine. There's a large library of complementary DNA out there, and geneticists are now capable of taking DNA and running a probe on it, finding the DNA they're after, in this case, healthy human prostate cancer DNA, and then putting it into a virus. In this case, they used vesicular stomatitis virus, essentially like a herpes virus, and they inject that into mice. The mice have an immune system which attacks the virus, and in doing so also creates antibody against healthy prostate cell tissue markers. Well, then you can take that sera and use it to kill prostate cancer cells. And what they found was once they created this virus, if you had a mouse that had been given experimentally human prostate cancer, once you gave them the virus, they mounted an antibody response and attacked the prostate cancer. This one might be usable in humans in, say, 5 years. And that could be a product that would not need to be personalized. That could get the cost down to something where it would be proportionate and rational to start using it to treat prostate cancer. My bet is whatever biotech company comes out with that vaccine is going to try marketing it as a preventative, because then they can sell it to every male over 50. And woohoo, wouldn't that be a huge cash cow for the pharmaceutical company? Let's hope that it works and doesn't have some untoward side effect. But this kind of level of science is going on all the time. And while I'm a little bit nervous about it from the social cost and how the heck are we going to balance the benefit and risk and cost of all of this, but from a scientific standpoint, I'm jazzed and fascinated. A story I'm not going to share with you today talks about how mice, this is done all the time. You simply decide that you want to get rid of a particular gene or you want to amplify a particular gene, and you can order up mice now. You just call up the mouse factory and tell them, I want this gene amplified, and they'll do it. It's done commercially and provided to university researchers all the time. We live in fascinating and interesting times scientifically. So we had an off-air question. How does one diagnose dystonia in the neck and jaw, and what are the treatments for it? Well, dystonia just means abnormal muscle tone, usually tight muscle tone, and its diagnosis is usually done by a neurologist. It is typically a clinical diagnosis, although it is possible to put little probes, basically a voltmeter, across the muscle and look at the action potentials, and it can be diagnosed that way. Failure of muscles to relax, which is similar to dystonia, can occur as a result of certain toxins. But in general, dystonia is, well, tetanus would be an example of that. But in general, dystonia is from abnormal nerve signals coming into the muscle rather than an abnormality in the muscle itself. In terms of treatment, muscle relaxants and neurologic drugs that calm down nerves, similar to the drugs used for epilepsy, are the primary therapies used. Let's go to Jackie in San Martin. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. Oh, hi. Thanks very much. Long-time listener. Love your show.
Thanks.
And I'm calling on behalf of my husband, who I just told him I'm on the air, so he's in the other room listening. I took him to the emergency room yesterday morning, and we were there for a quality 4 hours and brought him home with basically no diagnosis, and he's still not feeling too good. So I thought I'd give a try at maybe seeing any kind of advice you might have for him.
Well, tell me a little bit about your husband. How old is he?
He's about 53, mm-hmm. and he's in fairly good health.
Does he take any prescription medicines?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
No. And he did have a gallbladder taken out 2 years ago, and that seemed to go okay. And, you know, we just kind of do our really busy, busy life kind of things. And starting a week ago, last Sunday, he just started having kind of a general bloaty feeling in his abdomen, just below the rib cage, kind of above the belly, kind of between the rib cage and the belly button area.
Right.
And just a general bloated, you know, not feeling great.
And I'm sorry, that started last week, bloating and,
yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and so he just kind of lived with that. And then Friday morning, he felt worse. And we were going to book an appointment with a doctor. And by the time I got out of the shower, he was like in horrible groaning, moaning, you know, doubling over pain, which, of course, brought back memories of the day that he had his gallbladder attack. So I stuck him in the car and drove him to the emergency room. And he was in quite a bit of pain and discomfort there. And they did the blood test. They put him on an IV. They gave him some Mylanta and lidocaine to, you know, calm between the mouth and the stomach to see if that was the issue.
Did that help?
And it was hard to say for him because it kind of came and went in waves, and he was less painful at that time. So they did an ultrasound and an X-ray, and they, you know, looked at his pancreas, and they looked at the duct. His liver enzyme, only one of the liver enzymes, can't tell you which one, was a little high, but not horrendously. So they wanted to check his bile duct and then his pancreas and his liver and his kidneys. And they didn't find anything, and he was in less discomfort. They didn't really diagnose it as GERD, mm-hmm. but they said, well, here, take the famantidine, which is a double-strength Pepcid, and eat a blend or diet and drink a lot. And so he came home and rested and did, you know, he's been on that. But this morning, I mean, he's just kind of walking around feeling really miserable and having this pain. And I don't know what to do, that anything that can be done. And it's kind of, there was really no diagnosis.
Just out of curiosity, did he have any antibiotics before?
No.
Okay.
No, no. The only thing we did do is have an unusually huge meal at a ethnic restaurant, not spicy food, but just different, last Saturday, after which this started. And we all had a little indigestion because it was this big, massive meal, and it was different kind of food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you kind of expect a little indigestion kind of if you go out and do that sort of a thing. But his never really cleared up.
How much bloating after meals does your husband get at baseline? Is that a problem, or does he get gas?
No.
Okay.
Well, it's your typical gassy meal. But but nothing unusual, no. I mean, this has been kind of the first time he's ever exhibited this kind of problem, other than when he had the gallbladder attack.
Really? Okay. Well, I'll tell you, I'm thinking that I know what this might be. First of all, GERD is a possibility. Sometimes people don't have burning. You know, I wouldn't rule that out completely. And if it's what I think it may be, however, the H2 blocker is actually the wrong move. And I'll explain. Mm. First of all, people without a gallbladder are not able to necessarily produce enough bile to break down a lot of fat. So if there was a lot of fat in the meal, this would be consistent with him having a malabsorption issue. Fat malabsorption usually presents as diarrhea, and you haven't mentioned diarrhea, so I'm assuming he didn't have that.
No, not really.
Okay, so we'll put that on the back burner. I'm kind of doing a discursive here because there are probably other people out there in the audience who've had or will have similar issues, so I'm kind of running through the differential of things that they wouldn't have been able to pick up through conventional medical testing. Because remember, an emergency room is all about what's going to kill the patient. Is it a heart attack?
Right.
Is it an ulcer? And on the subject of ulcers, hopefully somebody bit the bullet and actually put a finger in your husband's butt and checked for bleeding. I have been...
No.
Yeah,
didn't.
You know, I was taught... Yeah, I was taught in medical school, and I'm going to just criticize emergency room physicians lately as a group, because for some reason they've gotten really shy about the finger in the butt. And I'm sorry, but if there's any possibility that someone has a bleeding ulcer, a verbal history of black poo is not what we're looking for. We're looking for, is there blood in the stool? Is there even a trace of blood in the stool? And you find that out by putting a glove on, putting some Vaseline on the glove or lubricant, getting a smear of what's inside that person's rectum, and doing a simple chemical test on it. And I am going to sound like an old lady now. In the olden days, we were taught never not. You know, any belly pain at all, you do a rectal exam. End of discussion. And they're skipping that step now. You know, they think that their tests and studies are so cool that they don't have to. And I really strongly disagree with that, because this could be a bleeding ulcer. All right. So hie thee down to the pharmacy and you get the Dr. Dina Dell or whatever brand poop cards that you can buy. And, you know, check the next poop for blood. That's important because people take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories without thinking of it. People can drink themselves into an ulcer. People can get H. pylori, which, by the way, causes bloating, and develop a bleeding ulcer. And they may not have typical ulcer pain or symptoms. Now, what I think may be going on with your husband, in fact, I'm pretty suspicious that this is the cause, is that he got a load of something that he wasn't able to digest, maybe just disaccharides, in other words, some kind of starch that he didn't have enough enzymes to break down. And so he's experiencing the human intestine equivalent of an algae bloom. So, you know, algae blooms happen when too much food, too much phosphate gets into the waterways, and then the algae go crazy and the lakes turn green, right? You've heard of that. Well, in our intestines, if you throw too much carbohydrate down there and you don't break it down, then the bacteria go, woohoo, let's have some babies. And you get rapid bacterial division, and you get a whole lot of gas forming because those bacteria break down the carbohydrate by fermentation, and that creates a lot of gas and bloating. So if every time he's eating, he's bloating or getting more gas, one thing he could try would be just going on a pure protein diet for a day or two.
And what about probiotics?
Probiotics are really helpful in this circumstance. That's kind of a germ warfare thing and, you know, widely available. And I would try treating this with probiotics, but I'd also try to starve the guys out. If it's a bacterial bloom, it would manifest exactly this way. And if the bloom is in the lower intestine, it would happen, you know, 12 hours after the meal. And if it's in the upper intestine, it could happen really close to the meal, like an hour later. And it may climb up into the upper intestine, in which case now the interval between eating and bloating gets shorter and shorter. And that's very diagnostic.
Yeah.
When that
right.
occurs...
Well, he kind of feels like he's always bloated.
At this point, I think I would recommend, and I wouldn't do antibiotics for this, although antibiotics are effective, because I try to do it without the antibiotics. And there are a number of things that are available over the counter at the health food store that work pretty well for this. So you could try it. He's had the medical workup, and never do this without the medical workup, because you want to eliminate the what will kill the patient stuff. You know, I love it when people show up in my alternative office and they've done the medical workup, because I don't have to worry about doing it. You know, somebody else has done the grunt work, and now I get to help solve the problem. That's, by the way, a very loose self-promotion in terms of my alternative medicine practice. But, you know, full disclosure. But oregano oil, widely available, well-tolerated, maybe 300 to 500 milligrams a day. You know, call it 300 milligrams. That's 4 or 5 pills for most of the concentrates that you'll find. Some people use rosemary. They like that. I've been using a lot of oregano lately, you know, subject to change without notice, and if I find something better. But oregano oil plus probiotics plus a low carbohydrate diet might just fix him up. And if it does, please call back and let us know.
Okay, yeah. So oregano oil.
Yeah.
Okay, oregano oil. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Good
and
luck.
We'll see, we can try this out and we'll let you know.
Yep. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Now, we had an off-air caller commenting on an earlier question, and I want to read this to you. Brother had some bloating symptoms, same bloating symptoms as the man talked about earlier, went many times to the emergency room with no luck, finally diagnosed as pancreatic cancer. And I think the big distinction here is that the brother had a chronic issue which was persistent. As far as what was causing it was inability to digest his carbohydrates or proteins or lipids, one of the above, because he wasn't putting out pancreatic enzymes. Since he wasn't breaking down the food, he had the bacterial bloom or the algae bloom phenomenon and had all of this bloating. So the why of his inability to digest, I hope, is very different than the caller's husband, because the caller's husband had an acute change. He'd been fine, and then he ate something unusual with a big load of something potentially unfamiliar, and then had symptoms. So if person doesn't respond to therapy for a presumed diagnosis, then you have to dig further and maybe do imaging studies. In general, the way to diagnose pancreatic cancer would be a CT scan, which is a lot of radiation. I don't order that test lightly, and I don't think he probably had that in the emergency room, although he may have. We didn't really get into that. She said x-ray and ultrasound, and I don't know if he had a CT. Let's go to Jackie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jackie, and welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about HCG.
Human chorionic gonadotropin. Right, that's the thing we test to make sure people are pregnant. I bet you're calling about the diet.
Well, here's the thing. I got some of it. My doctor blessed it, and I got some from Staff of Life. I got two kinds. I got a 15-day thing before I was going to go on a family trip. And it worked beautifully. It was great. I took off 10 pounds and I was very happy.
Appetite suppression, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just didn't feel hungry.
I didn't feel hungry. I had pretty good energy and I got through it. You know, that was a big deal to get through that.
Mm-hmm.
So then I tried it again with a 26-day thing because I have some more weight to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And this time, no weight came off. And I started, and pretty soon I got terrible diarrhea. And now I understand that those chemicals can break down.
Right.
And I wonder if you can comment on that and tell me where I can get some that I can count on.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to do the last one because,
okay,
number one, I'm very against this diet.
Oh, you are?
And I want to tell you why. And
okay.
And it has to do not with the diet itself. I mean, the idea here is that you're taking a substance, which I think we can all agree that when women are pregnant, they have very high levels of this, by the way, and they don't sprout horns or, you know, do have any adverse effect except that they have a baby, which is not an adverse effect most of the time. So we know it's safe for human consumption. Our bodies produce it in very high levels at certain circumstances. So, you know, taking it at a lower level is not such a bad thing in and of itself. They used to do this, by the way, 20 years ago, it was injected into people, and they used to use like purified pregnant, I think it was pregnant rabbits that they would get the HCG from. The reason for that was that it wasn't synthesized in a way that could be absorbed. Now, with liposomal technology, you can take a complex protein like HCG and actually get some percentage of it past the liver and into the general circulation, where it has a strong anti-hunger effect in non-pregnant individuals. So
also, they said it made you burn fat rather than muscle.
I'm not sure how good the data is on this. This would be plausible, though, because basically when you're hungry, when you're not eating, you physiologically first go to the protein sources and you pull as much protein as you can to make glucose because it's easier to make glucose out of protein. When our bodies try to run on pure fat, a process called lipolysis, the muscles do fine on fat. The heart does fine on fat. The brain actually does need glucose, and so it will continue to scavenge protein to feed the brain. But people get a kind of high when they fast, and that's because of the ketones, ketosis. It makes your breath smell like juicy fruit gum, and it also gives you a kind of a runner's high, although it's not a runner's high, but it's a euphoria. And you're, at least in testing situations, people who are running on ketones partially in their brain actually have better performance on test scores, which is kind of interesting. But the issue here is that even if you're getting fat burning instead of protein burning, you're going to be getting physiological pushback on a weight loss that's too rapid. And that's why I don't like this diet. If people would lose weight at 2 pounds a week taking this stuff, I would feel pretty much okay about it being done long term. But when you're losing 10 pounds in 10 days, some of that's fluid, but some of it's actual body weight. And there's going to be a physiologic shift in your metabolic rate. Your metabolic rate is going to drop in order to compensate for that rapid weight loss. The body doesn't want you to do that.
Well, what I did was I supplemented more protein than it said. It gave a 500 calorie, 3.5 ounces of protein twice a day, and then restricted vegetables and one fruit.
Right.
And I added non-fat milk to my coffee in the morning. And
right. So that's good.
Probably another 200 calories somewhere along the line, just to keep.
Yeah, so you were trying to selectively burn fat, which
right.
is good. You supported your protein.
And I didn't try to lose it a pound a day. It was a pound, what was 10 pounds in 15 days. So
Yeah, but that's still too fast.
That's still too fast.
If you lose weight that fast, your body pushes back. The trick is to sneak the weight loss under the body's threshold for fighting back.
You mean it pushes back in a way that's really bad for you? How does it push back?
It slows your metabolic rate. So you essentially burn fewer calories per hour. Your body fights you by dropping your metabolic rate. It changes the ratios of different signaling hormones. And ultimately what happens is if you lose weight that fast, you're going to gain it back.
No, I haven't. I've
yeah.
been off of it for 3 weeks.
Okay, honey, now, but we're talking, let's see what happens in the next 6 months.
Well, okay.
Okay.
I've never been able to, you know,
I know, it makes you feel wonderful, doesn't it? It makes you feel so great to finally have control over your appetite.
Yes.
I totally get that. I'm saying, okay, you go girl HCG, but you got to eat more. And so you don't lose the weight as quickly. Max yourself out at 2 pounds a week. And I'm okay with you doing this.
Okay. But,
and you will keep it off, assuming that you are exercising and are not losing muscle. If you lose muscle, you're in trouble. So you got to keep doing some kind of weightlifting, resistance exercise. You keep up with the high protein, drink a lot of water, build muscle. You burn fat, you build muscle, you get the fat to muscle ratio to shift. Then, because eventually we want you to start eating normally, because you're going to develop vitamin deficiencies if you are on a weight restrictive diet, even if you ate nothing but vegetables.
I did all my supplements.
Good. And so, you know, when you get to your goal weight, though, at some point you're going to need to stop losing weight. You're probably going to stop the HCG.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe just use it when you're going into situations where you're afraid you might overeat. That might be a good solution for you. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. But lose the weight more slowly if you want to keep it off.
But you don't have any comment about what happened when I got sick from the second batch and I didn't lose weight, even though I was really, you know, keeping as much to it.
There's so many different possibilities.
Okay.
It could be a coincidence. It could be that your enzymes changed and now you're breaking down the HCG faster. It could be that this was a different batch and the liposome.
It was a different brand and
right.
a different batch.
So maybe the technology on that batch isn't as good and you didn't absorb the HCG. So you developed what's called an osmotic diarrhea. To me, malabsorption, not getting it in, is probably the explanation for what happened. This stuff is not regulated by the FDA. Batches are not created equal. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if the FDA comes down on this stuff in the next year or two just because, you know, this really is a drug and it's being sold as a food. I know. So healthy weight loss while you can and maybe stock up on the good stuff.
So what kind of a diet would you suggest?
Oh, well, thanks for the question. The diet that I suggest is a diet that is extremely low in simple sugars and starches, very high in vegetables and high fiber legumes as a protein source. I really mm-hmm. like legumes. I ask people to eat 3 servings of protein a day, 1 or 2 servings of legumes, unlimited vegetables. They get 1 starch serving, which is a piece of bread or a bowl of whole wheat cereal, and measured amounts. Fruit is your dessert, so you get 2 pieces of fruit a day. Call it the salmon and salad diet. Call it the paleo diet. Call it the South Beach diet, they're all essentially overlapping on the same basic concepts, which have been scientifically validated over and over again, is this is the diet that allows you to lose weight.
I think I gain weight on it.
Well, I'm going to sign off now.
Thank
but
you very much.
I appreciate your question.
Again, and I'll, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And let's go now to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the program.
I have a spasm somewhere in my intestine so that nothing's getting into the colon. And let's see, two Thursdays ago, I got caught in really bad traffic and got real contracted. So that's sort of an ordinary thing for me to happen to me. But it's been a week and a half. So a little bit gets past this contraction, but it's really hard to get out because there's no peristalsis. The peristalsis bangs into the spasm. And, you know, I've taken Miralax. I've taken Hycosamine. I've taken a lot of magnesium. I've taken probiotics. I've been to the acupuncturist. I got a belly massage with acupressure. I do acupressure on myself.
Has this been a chronic recurrent condition for you?
It is a chronic condition, but it's never closed so significantly.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, have you had any abdominal surgeries in your life?
No.
Never virgin belly, no appendix out, no laparoscopic tubal ligation, nothing?
Correct.
Okay.
And I'm leaving on Tuesday for a camping trip. So I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about burst bowel and, you know, no hospitals.
Right.
And
right. Yeah, I know. That little guy in the left brain can really get crazy at 3 in the morning.
Right, right. So I didn't get back to sleep till 5. Uh-huh. You know, missed the first 15 minutes of your show.
How much pain are you in?
Not that much. You know, if I take Trifla, which is right, you know, increases.
And no vomiting.
Right, no vomiting. You know, it moves down to the spasm, which is in the lower left quadrant, in a familiar space.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
I'm worried that there's a twist rather than just a spasm.
Yes. Well, the twist is called a volvulus, and you would have much greater level of symptomology if you had a volvulus.
Okay, good.
Really severe pain, vomiting, because when that happens, the body's smarter than the brain. And under those circumstances, the body says, we are clearing out the decks, and you start vomiting, and the body wants to clear everything that's north of the volvulus.
Yes.
And so that's really an evidence-type thing. It's very, very florid.
Okay, that's reassuring.
Now, the spasm, it's really unusual for people to maintain a fixed spasm for as long as you're describing.
Oh, years.
Well, maybe recurrent spasm, but a fixed spasm, the muscles just fatigue out and open up and relax.
You would think.
Yeah, so I'm worried that you have scar tissue, what's called a stricture, rather than a spasm. Now, that could have happened from a diverticular infection. It wouldn't have had to have been surgical. But if you have literally a scar so the intestine doesn't open up, that makes a lot more sense for the symptoms you're describing to me. The other possibility, really hard to tell apart, is anyone who is eating breakfast, please close your ears, la, 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 la. The other possibility is that you've got a big, hard wad of poo that's just trapped at a kink in your intestine and creating an effective stricture, but it's not really a stricture. That's called an impaction. And, you know, if you think about a log jam on the river,
right.
You know, that's exactly what it's like. It's a log jam. Dynamite works for a log jam. What works for this would be enemas. And so the first thing I would do is try that, because by now you will have a backlog anyway.
I have done enemas.
Mm-hmm.
And I get something.
Keep going. You know, you may be eroding away at this. Imagine that you had a hose and you had a big wad of mud and you're trying to move the mud with the hose. It's going to take a lot of water.
Well, the massage therapist suggested a colonic. Mm-hmm. And I'm...
This is one of those circumstances where, you know, I'd be inclined to agree.
Yeah.
Carefully done by someone who knows what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
You know, not the local teenage enema nurse, but, I mean, a real professional.
Yeah.
That's an old favorite song of mine, so...
Okay.
Okay. So, good luck. And, I would work on this now because you definitely could get into an uncomfortable situation on your camping trip.
The medicine Miralax. Mm-hmm. you know,
it takes about 3 days to kick in, and it softens poo.
Yeah, I've been taking small amounts rather than the whole dose because I didn't want to create, you know, that havoc. But
yeah,
I should probably take a full dose.
Yeah, I think at this point, since you have a deadline here,
yeah,
I think it's time to blast.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. And, you know, just in general, a barium enema, which is a diagnostic study that we do when we're trying to find out what's wrong with people, barium enema is actually a pretty effective laxative, although it's the diagnostic therapy, if you will. I do think that if she had pain or fever, it would be really important to go to a doctor right away. Let's talk to Andrew in Watsonville. Hello, Andrew, and thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you. So I wanted to talk to you about prostate cancer today.
Okay.
And I missed what you were talking about earlier, but I actually had heard you on an earlier show where you used the metaphor about creating a desert for your prostate cancer.
Right.
For cancer in your body, and
right.
Really like that analogy. But I'd like to tell you, I have a few questions and just wanted to tell you about my situation and see what you would offer up. So, you know, I was diagnosed like 8 months ago. I have a Gleason 3+3, T1C, you know, low grade. They found 2 cores positive with, you know, very small amounts, like 3-4%
right.
In each core. And so, you know, after looking at the options, I decided to go on active surveillance. So that's what I'm doing. You know, my PSA was up around, it was only the highest was around 4, just over 4 when I did my biopsy. And so, you know, I've been trying to make some lifestyle changes to address this. You know, these diet, exercise, supplements.
What dietary changes have you made?
Well, just trying to increase my vegetable intake, particularly cruciferous vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
I've eliminated red meat. I'm eating more fish.
Okay, those are all good things. All right. And so what questions do you have?
Well, in terms of just supporting this effort to create this desert, you know, what you might have to say, and also particularly around supplement issues. I mean, I was just wondering what you thought of some of the supplements that I'm taking.
Okay.
So,
well, why don't we first cover diet, because that's quick, and then we can go through the supplements one by one. There's actual scientific evidence that a vegetarian diet reduces the aggressiveness of prostate cancer cells on biopsy. This is a pretty good data. It was a study that Dean Ornish did. You can look it up. I believe it was published in the journals of urology in 2009. And I might be a little bit wrong on the year, but you know, just look up Dean Ornish in PubMed and you'll find the article. It's a really solid study that showed that you could take people with prostate cancer and alter the physiological characteristics of their cancers, making them less aggressive, and you're already not very aggressive, so making yours even less aggressive gets you into the situation where you just have a chronic disease. How old are you, by the way?
52.
52. Okay, so you've got, you know, 30 years to live, which means we do have to worry about even a low-grade prostate cancer becoming more aggressive, and so the concept of having an adverse environment for the cancer, and the converse is a healthy environment for the immune system, so that if the cancer starts to become more aggressive, you've got the immune system to deal with it. And because you're doing things that are lowering the redox status of your body, less oxidative stress, less free radicals, you're going to have less chance of more mutations. And, you know, just in general principle, reducing mutagenic foods, making sure that you don't consume a lot of barbecue, particularly as, you know, nitrosamines, barbecued cured meats, things like that. But I really like the Dean Ornish diet because it also lowers your risk of heart disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes, all kinds of things. Why not go on that diet? And just
and that diet is a vegetarian, you said, but in particular.
Yeah, he has a couple of books out. It's essentially the Spectrum Diet, which is the title of one of his books. So you can easily access that information.
Okay.
What about the supplements? What are you taking?
Well, in addition to my multivitamin, I'm taking extra A through E.
Okay.
And then I'm doing curcumin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm drinking, you know, 8 ounces of pomegranate juice a day. And I also have some pomegranate supplements as well.
Okay.
And I also wanted to ask you, I had read some article about turkey tail mushroom fighting prostate cancer in particular.
Yeah, mushroom extracts are really interesting compounds. They have a lot of very bioactive agents that do seem to stimulate the immune system quite well. And there's extensive literature on that. Much of it is not in English, but there are enough translations. Reishi and shiitake are probably the ones that have the largest body of research. But the turkey tail, and you will be able to find extracts. You want hot water extracts, or you want water extracts of the, not the mycelium, but the fruiting body. And so you have to read the labels carefully.
But you want the fruiting body?
The fruiting body, rather than the mycelia, which are the rootlets. So that's an important distinction. And it's much cheaper to just grow the mycelia and extract that. And legally, you can call that a mushroom extract. But it doesn't have anything like the levels of active compound.
Okay.
So it is important to get the right mushroom. And I always recommend mushroom extracts for immune support in my patients who are battling cancer. I think that there's enough data there to really support it. And at a recent conference, one person working in the cancer field said, rotate the mushrooms. So 1 month of reishi, 1 month of shiitake, 1 month of maiyake, and switch around on the mushrooms. And they felt that there might be what's called tachyphylaxis. In other words, when you use a decongestant every day, it stops working very well. Mm-hmm. So you have body resistant, which develops. And they cited some studies, which I haven't read, and said, you know, try switching them around. And that might be better than taking the same thing over long periods of time.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought so. Now,
lycopene is one of it.
Yeah, lycopene, I think, mostly works on the front end, like before the horse has left the barn, rather than on the back end where you have already got the cancer. Most of the studies, I think, are epidemiologic studies looking at rates of cancer occurrence rather than treating the cancer with the lycopene.
So what about the pomegranate?
Pomegranate's an antioxidant, and so far as I know, most of the research is, again, it's at the front end. Now, it's not bad to prevent further cancers, and antioxidants are a good idea because you don't want further mutation within your cancer. So the idea that you're sort of protecting your cancer with the antioxidants and you're protecting it from further mutation is kind of a legitimate thought.
And what's your take on curcumin?
Wonderful stuff. We should put it in the food supply. Yeah, I think curcumin is really good. I'm not aware of any specific studies looking at, you know, direct or indirect toxicity on cancer, of any kind, prostate cancer in particular. I just don't know that literature well enough to comment fully on your question. But, you know, the easy way to find out about these things is you go to Google Scholar, which is a beta site for Google, and you put in your two things, so curcumin and prostate cancer, and then stand back, take a sip of water, and boom, the entire medical literature is searched before your eyes, and you have article after article after article that you can look through, and you're looking for something that's done in humans and not lab rats, if possible. If you know,
that's Google Scholar.
Google.Scholar. Yeah, just Google Scholar.
Okay.
It's an extension of Google. I think it's scholar.google.com.
One other thing is, you know, this issue around testosterone is a little confusing, because I have heard that both, higher levels of testosterone are maybe a problem and are bad, or low levels, or it depends on which kind of testosterone. And then I had also heard that it might be taking progesterone might be a good thing.
Right. The idea with the testosterone is that if you look epidemiologically, you would think if testosterone was bad for prostate cancer, you would think that the people who had the highest levels of testosterone before they got cancer would get more cancer. And we do see that, by the way, with estrogen. Women who have high levels of estrogen compared to the average woman have a higher rate of breast cancer. So, you know, it's natural to assume that's with prostate cancer. Turns out it's the opposite. So in terms of cancer attack rates, it's higher in the men with the lowest levels of testosterone, which is confusing. But I wouldn't extrapolate that to say that taking testosterone is good for prostate cancer, especially in the face of studies that show that blocking testosterone doubles the lifespan or cuts in half the rate of death from the prostate cancer in intermediate cases. I mean, that's a pretty strong study that says that testosterone is not good for you after you have prostate cancer.
Okay, and do you know about numbers? I mean, do you want to know my numbers?
I'm sorry, your PSA numbers?
No, my testosterone.
You know, no, I don't. I think we're getting a little close to the line here in terms of that. Plus, we're running out of time.
Okay. And just any comment on progesterone, though?
Progesterone gets converted into testosterone fairly readily. And the same thing with DHEA. And since we can't really predict how fast it's going to be converted, at this point, I'm not recommending progesterone therapy for prostate cancer until I see a study in human males with prostate cancer. And then I might consider, you know, saying it's a good idea. But I just don't think you can extrapolate from the test tube here.
Okay. Any other advice you would have for beating this thing back further?
Regular exercise and keep your body fat down to a healthy level. If you can have 15% or 16% body fat, that would be really good. Okay?
Okay.
Good luck to you. And I think you're in a good place. And there's plenty of time for these vaccines I've been talking about to be developed before you need them.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And our last caller raises an interesting question, which is, did we do him a favor by diagnosing low-grade prostate cancer? Maybe he would have been better off to have lived in blissful ignorance until the age of 79 when he was hit by a truck. Have we helped him? We turned him into a person with a disease in our current medical environment. We've also made him virtually uninsurable. And yet, there's really not a lot of data that he's going to die from this disease, that it's going to have any impact on him, except the impact we've created by finding it. So we need to be really careful about labeling people. And I think prostate cancer is one where we've really gone a little bit overboard. It has been a wonderful day and going to be an even more wonderful day. So get out there and exercise. I want to thank all of the callers and all of the emailers, and I will get to those emails next week. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.